Well, good morning. This is Per Fagering and Fight the Empire. Today is also Tax Day. This is the day we go down and feed the Pentagon. The war tax resistors are having an event tonight at the Unitarian Church on 12th and Salmon. It starts at 6 o'clock with general strikes, so you know I'll be there. And then the main speaker is Brian Wilson, the anti-war activist, longtime anti-war activist. So that is happening tonight at the Unitarian Church. And our guest is Michael Parenti. Michael, are you there?
Yes.
Hey, welcome to KABU.
Hello.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. This came on the internet last night. This is from it's a website called Arutz Sheva, which is the Israeli settlers' TV station. And this is Lieutenant General Gabi Ashkenazi was speaking to participants in an international Bible quiz for youth. And he said the IDF, that's the Israeli Defense Force, the military, the IDF sees the Bible as a guide in the deep and practical sense of the word. It is no accident that the IDF swears in its soldiers with a weapon in one hand and the Bible in the other. So anyway, Michael, what do you think of that?
It shows that the Bible has been used as a kind of a deed. It's not scriptures about past beliefs and mythologies and whatever, but it's being used as a kind of proof of a deed that, you know, see, we were in these areas 2,000 years ago, and the Palestinians have occupied this area for only 500 years, but we were there 2,000 years before that, and so therefore this really belongs to us. It became a document that justifies the expropriation of land. I do deal with the Bible in my book.
Let's tell people what the book is. It's called God and His Demons, and it's sort of a rundown on a history of the abuses of various religions through the centuries. And we are talking with the author of that book, Michael Parenti. So anyway, tell us what kind of God are these people thinking about?
Oh, it's an extraordinary God. Only the first two chapters of the book deal with the Bible. First three chapters, first two deal with the Old Testament God, and then the third chapter deals with Jesus, who's another case. If you read it closely, you find that Jesus is not the sweet, loving, all perfect guy that many people try to make him out to be. He's got a really good press, but he too is full of threat and apocalyptic violence, and you must believe in me and only me, and you will get there only through me and such. And generally what the Bible is about, it captures the essence of religious intolerance and religious aggrandizement and that sort of thing. So I document a lot of that stuff by just letting the religionists speak for themselves. I don't commit any rant or diatribe or attacks, which is what some of the religious critics have been accusing me of. Not at all. I let these people speak for themselves, and it's a pretty horrendous picture that comes out. It's not really a loving God at all. It's a God of violence who systematically eggs on the Israelites to slaughter men, women, and children.
Yeah, committing genocide.
Yeah, committing genocide here and there and again. So that's the first three chapters. And then I also go into all the other things about the pursuit of money, the pursuit of power, the corruption of that power and the use of it for material success and accumulation of money and for predatory sex and for all those things. When you write about religion, you find you're writing about violence and predatory sex and money and political power and intolerance and hatred of each other. Most of the violence committed against religionists are from other religionists, sometimes from people in the very same denomination who say you're doing it wrong or saying it wrong or something, or from another denomination. Even with Buddhism, which we usually think of Buddhism as being a little different from the other religions, I do have a couple of chapters on that most sanctified form of Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism. Even Tibetan Buddhism consists of four denominations that have a history of attacking and hating each other and fighting each other, including the Dalai Lama's sect. So one should not have any illusions. And then I carefully do point out that there are people, religionists, who do use their religion in a very good way, and who, for whom religion has been a good thing, the source of good acts and good actions and helping their fellow man. But generally, I have a quote in there by Bertrand Russell, Russell, who said, we're told not to criticize religions because religions make men good. I haven't noticed it, and that's his statement.
Mm-hmm. Let's get back to the chapter on Jesus, because, you point out that there are Bible scholars who say that, the real Jesus was something entirely different. In fact, there's a fellow named Bruce Chilton who wrote Rabbi Jesus, and his take on Jesus is that he was preaching how the Jewish people could be saved from the Roman Empire. And he sort of generally fit in the strategy of civil disobedience. So there's this sweet Jesus that sort of the Sunday school version is kind of false.
Well, excuse me. There are those who make that claim, and I can find a passage, and I do quote that passage right there in the book, that he says, I am serving only the children of Israel. So he is a sort of a Messiah. He does come across rather consistently in the scriptures as someone who expects an apocalypse coming soon.
Oh, I think that was definitely true, right?
That's he's very explicit about that. He says, this generation shall be the one that will see the gates of heaven open up.
Right.
So you better get ready and you better choose and that sort of thing. Now, this whole idea that, but this isn't the real Jesus. There's a real Jesus that never made it into the scriptures who's really very different. That's as old as Benjamin Franklin, Franklin made the point that, from all we know is the Bible scriptures have been tampered with and Jesus may really be, something other. And you have different people saying different things that Jesus was, one people will say Jesus was really revolutionary, the other will say he was a Jewish Messiah. Not a very impressive Messiah, because the Jews were not expecting a dirt poor preacher with a scruffy lot of followers walking around from town to town. They expected some powerful king, glorious king, would come and roll back the Romans and drive them out and take over the country.
A lot of Christians expected that too. That's sort of what's in the book of Revelation.
Yeah, in Revelation you get that. Yeah, I wanted to say something. I just wanted to say that all those imaginary Jesuses that everybody says didn't make it into the Bible don't count. I only deal with the Jesus that's in the King James Version, because that is the Bible that most of Protestant America has used most of its life, especially fundamentalist Protestant America. And it's also the Bible that has donated so many phrases and expressions to our language. I mean, just in the Book of Matthew, there's about 10 different expressions that we used to use until TV and internet comes in. Of course, now the literary quality of the American English language is pathetic now, but we used to. And that's the Bible that that regiments of ministers use. They will pick it up when they say, it's all right here in the Bible, and you should read the Bible. That's what they mean. So that's what I did. I obeyed them. I read the Bible. I read what they were saying, and it's kind of amazing what's in that Bible. I mean, mm-hmm. the violence and the madness and the irrationality and the cruelty and such.
Well, of course, it's not just the you know,
and
the
some beautiful passages too. Mm-hmm. Here we should point out, you know, there are some very memorable passages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's not just the Jewish military that goes along that has this mindset. It's the American, you know, the American army has been, their troops have been taking their Bibles with them into Iraq and having prayer sessions and all sorts of things. And mm-hmm. you know, you go into some of the Colorado Springs, which is kind of run by the military, you know, the Air Force Academy, which is apparently evangelical ministers have taken over the chaplain corps, you know, the
yeah.
mainstream Protestants, Catholics, and Jewish chaplains are sidetracked.
Yeah, I dealt with that in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I spoke at the Air Force Academy years ago, but I invited by the Political Science Department, as a matter of fact. But
really?
Yeah, but I could not, I couldn't get near it now because it has been taken over by these fundamentalists and they've pretty much pushed aside the mainstream Protestant chaplain and the Catholic chaplain and the Jewish chaplain. And they, they've been running the place in a way that bears no resemblance to the constitutional mandate. I mean, separation of church and state is pretty well violated, consistently violated in this case.
Well, it's a case of kind of religion and the empire are one and the same.
Pardon me?
Religion and the empire are kind of one and the same.
Yeah, this religion that is moving into the military of the United States is not a social justice or liberation theology religion. It doesn't say we must work for the betterment of humans and all. It's purely proselytizing, and it's purely excuse me. I have the spirits are fighting back on me, I guess. Here we go. It's not a very kind religion. It's a very intolerant, proselytizing, aggrandizing religion. I have a quote in there by was it Ralph Reed or Terry Randall? I can't remember which one of those two. I think it was Randall, who said, we are not looking for equal time. We are not committed to pluralism. We want to take over. We want this country and all of its institutions to belong to Christ, and that's that. And it's a view which you find in almost all these religions, which is, look, I believe with all my heart, I have faith, and there's some kind of credit or exaltation or admiration if you can demonstrate that you are believing completely, unquestioningly. We use it in our language. We say he's a man of deep faith. Like, this is a very admirable and virtuous thing, that he believes something not through reason, not through empirical evidence, not through discussion, but by faith. So you start off and you say, I believe in this. This is my faith. This is my sacred faith. This is therefore true. if I didn't believe it was true, I wouldn't believe in it. I wouldn't believe in false things. But if it's true, then what you believe is false. Then you are leading people astray from the most important thing in life, which is your immortal soul and your immortal life after death and all that. If I allow you to lead people astray, I'm betraying my belief and this is to the harm of others. So I'm obliged to crush your belief or to not allow false belief to come into play that way. And my God is the one true God, and he is an intolerant God. I heard a Protestant minister say, you must understand that ours is an intolerant God. And he was saying it with a big, happy, proud smile on his face. I says, this guy's serious. But he is. And you get that element in Islam. You get it in Hinduism. You get it in Judaism. You get it you get it in spades in Christianity.
Well, it's, in a way, I suppose you could trace it back to, you know, the Christians. The early Christians were persecuted until the year 300 and something, when Constantine, the emperor of Rome, converted or used Christianity for his own ends, and all of a sudden it's the official religion of the Roman Empire.
Yeah, let me just correct something there. They were not persecuted for 300 years. They were just...
kind of off and on, or
there were a few periods. Mm-hmm. You can count two, and one under Nero, and one under a later emperor. And even when Justinian tried to bring back paganism, he didn't go out and kill any Christians. They were too strong. Constantine would not have made them an official religion if they hadn't shown organization and collaborated with him and supported him and all that.
Mm-hmm.
He was impressed by them, and also they had recruited not from the poor and the downtrodden and the enslaved, not at all. They prohibited slaves from being deacons and pastors in their church. They did not encourage slaves to become Christians and all that. They mostly recruited from rather people from prosperous background, as with today. I mean, exotic religions today in America. You don't see homeless people or blue collar, hard working people becoming Buddhists or going into ashrams and this and that. It's something for the middle and upper middle class, people of advanced education and such, who indulge in these pursuits. And so when Constantine made Christianity, he made it one of the official religions, or actually became the official. That was a real boom, because then they started getting money and churches built and payoffs from the state.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't long before it was realized that once you make Christianity an official religion, it becomes the official religion. And they shut down the pagan temples and destroyed them and burned the secular libraries and all the books in these libraries.
Mm-hmm.
And they really worked very hard for the next century to bring in the Dark Ages. We always think of the Christian church as being the haven against the Dark Ages. You know, the image of the monks keeping learning alive with the books and such. Well, it's just not true. I mean, there were libraries in the ancient world. And in Rome alone, there were numerous libraries with hundreds of thousands of scrolls and books and volumes. All of those were burned. The great Library of Alexandria was destroyed by the Christians.
Hmm.
Because the goal was to have people study the only one true scripture.
The only book they need to know.
Yeah, and Augustine himself said it. Augustine bemoaned all the learning he got in history and philosophy and rhetoric and all that. He said, that's all just garbage in my mind. I wish I could just wipe all that out and focus just on the Gospels and give all my life, my meditation, attention to every word in the Gospels. And that was their goal for themselves and for everybody else that they would impose on everybody else.
Well, we got about 8 minutes left, so I'd like to get into two topics and then that people don't know too much about. One is Mother Teresa, and the other is Tibet. So why don't we start with Mother Teresa? There's a wonderful quote that, well, it's not so wonderful. It's kind of horrifying that Mother Teresa talks about the pain that their people in her hospitals felt. And she said, pain is Christ kissing you.
Yes, she did very little for the people. And the hospital that she set up in Calcutta was a hospice, really. People mm-hmm. went there to die. People from the West who came, and or even from India itself, who came and volunteered to work, medical personnel, for instance, were very appalled to find that people who were coming in, some of them, many of them who were dying, were people who had treatable diseases that could be treated and they'd be okay. And Mother Teresa said, God will sort them out, or don't worry about it, or, you know, that's not my... and they were, many of them were appalled, and they left. And I there's a very thorough book on Mother Teresa by an Indian, a Calcuttan guy named Chatterjee, and there have been a couple of biographies that were very favorable toward her, which even they admit there were all sorts of things that were wrong about it. The book that popularized it, first popularized it in the West, a criticism of Mother Teresa, was Hitchens' book on Mother Teresa. And but as I say, there's lots of other materials, and they're very revealing. When she died, there were no crowds in Calcutta along the street. The streets were empty or indifferent, totally indifferent to her hearse moving along. And she herself, while she gave very little to the poor, and she exaggerated and constantly changed the numbers of the children she was feeding or the people she was supposedly tending to, she herself, when she got ill, got state-of-the-art medical care in some of the finest hospitals in Europe and the United States, and was jetted around everywhere. She collected millions of dollars, and to this day we're not quite sure where that money has gone, what banks it was put into. But her main interest really was in building up the order of the sisters. And when she died, they discovered her diaries, which showed that she was riddled with doubt about God, said, all I see is darkness, and is there really a God? People see me as a source of faith, if they only knew. Well, that's the only part of Mother Teresa I really liked. I mean, mm-hmm. she was being human there and full of human doubt. So that's all I can say about Mother Teresa. The couple of times I heard her speak, I didn't hear a saint at all. I heard a crabby, irritated, impatient woman.
Hmm.
So I'm not a particularly adoring fan of hers.
Okay, let's get on to Tibet.
Well, Tibet... I just simply point out that old Shangri-La Tibet, now it's the habit of people to say, of course it wasn't a Shangri-La, but they used to, until we publicized what went on there, they used to call it a Shangri-La, a place where the culture was, people lived in this symbiosis together in warmth and faith, and the peasant and the lamas and everybody were living in this wonderful culture together, spiritual and pristine and all that. It really wasn't a closer examination of old Tibet, and that's what I attack. I don't attack Buddhism as a particular system of belief. And in fact, there's a lot of Buddhism which is kind of useful, meditation and contemplations and things, which can be helpful to people, I reckon. I show that old Tibet was just a place where the lords and the lamas really ruled and crushed the peasants into a system of serfdom and poverty and toil and taxation. Their 9-year-old sons could be taken from them and put into the monasteries for sexual purposes or to be act as servants or to be recruited as monks or soldiers or actors or whatever amusement the church wanted. So it was not a system that people were in debt, and those debts were inherited from generation to generation. The Dalai Lama has come out and said he would abolish that, and but it's already been abolished by the Chinese. He said he would not, if he would not reinstitute that when he returned to Tibet, if and when he returned. That's good to know. But generally, it was not something that won my admiration, and it's the truth about Tibet ought to be told. That's all it just seemed to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would feel a lot better about the Dalai Lama if it wasn't for all the CIA money that was going to him.
Yeah, he's in the pay of the CIA. I mean, that was right in the...
To what extent? I mean, how far is he?
Well, he and his brother are both getting full amounts.
Mm-hmm.
Getting full support, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And he also gets money from the Indian Secret Service. And he, for a while, and he was getting support from George Soros. And he does not denounce, the Dalai Lama is not a pacifist. He, on the Iraq War, he says the jury's still out. It's hard to decide about the Iraq War if it's good or bad. And he talks about when people confronted him about the violence that his denomination was recently doing against some heretical sect. He said he didn't know anything about it, but that violence is sometimes necessary, can be used for good as well as evil. So he's not at all a pacifist. People think he's a nonviolent. He's certainly nonviolent when the violence is directed against his denomination. So I don't particularly, one way or the other, I don't particularly have any great admiration for the Dalai Lama. I don't have any great animus either. As a religious figure, I prefer him to Mother Teresa, or to John Paul, mm-hmm. John Paul II, who sheltered pedophiles and who supported right-wing reactionary movements and who was instrumental in destroying liberation theology through Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
So those people, a lot of people, have done some pretty wicked things.
And don't forget Pope Ratzinger.
And Cardinal Ratzinger, now Pope Benedict XVI, who has a record of covering up. What we have now is a cover-up of the cover-up, covering up the amount of emotional corruption and sexual predation.
Well, one of the strongest denunciations of Ratzinger was from a Catholic priest I met, actually on tax day. He was down in front of the federal building with a sign that said, "Your tax dollars at work," and had pictures of dead Salvadorans and ditches and things. And we got to talking. He was quite a guy, and he really disliked Cardinal Ratzinger, now the Pope, quite a lot. But we've been talking with Michael Parenti, who's the author of Gods and His Demons. And this book has just come out, and we will be talking some more 3 weeks from today on May 6th, and this will be during our pledge drive. And so there's a lot to read in this book, a lot of interesting stuff. And thank you very much for being with us.
All right, thank you.
And we will see you again in May.
All right.
Okay, this is Per Fagrang, Fight the Empire, and stay tuned for Air Cascadia.